You made it. Welcome to part two of the interview with Andrea Shorter. Pull your coffee close, get your earbuds in. If you're in the car, turn up the volume. And let's get ready to listen to the rest of the interview. Here we go.
Right. I mean, that's, you have to know who you're, you have to know the room, you have to know who you're speaking to. Otherwise, I mean, that's part of the responsibility of the speaker. And, you know, in the political world, you have to know who your room is, because that's how you're going to generate money and votes. So let me ask
this.
Thank you. Let me ask you this, buddy. What type of speaker do you think you are?
I think it depends. I think that it depends on what the occasion is and what's called for.
Okay.
I think I'm someone that's able to adapt and to pivot.
I think that
by and large, for instance, tomorrow I'll be speaking before I go annual, or at this point kind of biannually, to speak before a women's studies class at San Francisco State University. And so I'm the guest lecturer.
Nice.
And so, you know, certainly in an academic environment, I'm not necessarily asked to come to be there as an academic per se, but mm-hmm. to be there as someone that can provide a kind of social political analyses mm-hmm. Around leading up to the midterms, the Me Too movement, our last mayoral race in San Francisco. And so I think that the way that I would be speaking before that particular audience, which are students, graduate students, mm-hmm. would be different than I would speak before a rally, right?
Definitely, so just, yes, right? Yes, yes.
Yeah, so how you're speaking before a rally and you know, moving people towards a particular cause or take action, how you're speaking on the steps of City Hall or et cetera, is different than, you know, how I would perhaps present within the classroom. But it doesn't necessarily mean that I may not bring the same kind of or similar spirit mm-hmm. that perhaps my approach or my way of conveying my ideas or engaging that audience. Mm-hmm. I think that ultimately I am someone that is a stronger activist. I probably fall more into sort of an activist tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, the idea of sort of that soapbox in the university square.
Megaphone and soapbox, definitely.
Right, yeah. Right. But like I said, that doesn't always translate well. It depends on who your audience is. I'm also someone.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
No, go ahead.
Well, I said I'm also someone, you know, I sit on a policy body, or I'm a commissioner. And
please tell us what you're commissioner for, which commission in San Francisco?
I serve on the Commission on the Status of Women in San Francisco. And
I've been there now for
18 years. So I'm actually the longest serving commissioner on that commission. And it's 44 years old. Mm-hmm. I really am just absolutely honored and humbled to be a part of that commission. So let me ask you this.
When you're mm-hmm. wearing your commissioner hat, describe your communication style when you're sitting in chambers as a commissioner, as opposed to being mm-hmm. an activist.
Right. Well, I think that what's interesting is that particular commission or commission such as that, they're very, very rare. Mm-hmm. You know, our commission is somewhat different in its origin story than perhaps the commission that oversees the Port Authority or the planning, mm-hmm. you know, commission, or what I refer to as sort of more regulatory commissions. It doesn't mean that you don't bring your values, your politic, and your worldview to the conversation and to the process of governing, right? But we're not a regulatory commission, and or don't oversee a regulatory agency in the same way that those commissions do. So I think that being on this particular commission, what it has allowed, you know, folks like me, and right now I'll say perhaps more specifically me, given my tenure on the commission, is that I'm still there as a person who is invested in women's liberation and the women's movement, right? So I'm there still as an activist. I'm very aware that I am also there as a as an official. I'm a sworn official. And ultimately, my role is like any other commissioner on any other commission, and that is to govern, right? And so how do you, so, you know, sitting on a on the commission, it's not to be there always as a firebrand on, you know, this issue and give, you know, stand up and give speeches or et cetera. But certainly there are issues that come before us, where I think that it still is necessary to honor the purpose and the tradition and intent of the commission and why it is chartered, to really continue to move towards, to really move ideas of social justice and equity or equality and fairness, and the treatment and elevation of the quality of children, and really for all San Franciscans. So I think that in that type of setting, it behooves us. It's it is absolutely incumbent for us to not just be there as sort of any other sort of commissioner body, but really to be able to move forward in the spirit of movement. Okay. And so, you know, like I said, it's not to say that each commission meeting or each opportunity that to speak on issues, that you have to give a big firebrand speech, but, you know, really how to translate that, those interests, those concerns, into effective public policy. How do we affect public policy on you know, a variety of issues that remain challenges for women: sexual harassment in the workplace, sexual assault, domestic violence, you know, a variety of issues, certainly equity or mobility within the workplace, public safety, you know, in the community. So there's a gamut of issues. All issues affect women, and women can affect those issues favorably. I think that if we don't abandon sort of the spirit of movement, but also understanding our role, you know, to affect change as governors over a body that can move policy and implement, you know, those needed changes.
Right.
So, you know, for me, I'm kind of wearing a variety of hats.
Yes, you are.
Not only on that commission. I, you know, just recently was invited to up to Seattle for my old workplace, which is out in Equal. That's an organization that works with Fortune 1000 companies at this point. We say Fortune Fortune 500, but now it's Fortune 1000 companies on diversity and inclusion of LGBT people in the workplace.
And I just want to confirm that name, because we cut out, it's what Out and Equal is the name of your former.
Right.
Yes.
Out and Equal Workplace Advocates, where I served as a director of community relations for a few years. And but was invited to come back to its annual summit, which is a large conference. I mean, it is a mega conference. It's one of the larger LGBT focused gatherings in the country.
Congratulations on that.
Yeah, well, I didn't do anything this year to make Summit happen, but I'm glad that it happened. It was the largest. There were 6,000 plus persons involved from I don't know how many companies, probably about 400 companies. So it was really wonderful. But what I was there, was invited to do, was to come and speak before one of the events, which was a breakfast for governmental leaders. Mm-hmm. And decided this year, while that particular organization, and certainly you're working with a number of like I said, multinational corporate entities, it tends to stay somewhat apolitical, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, certainly, you know, which ideas, very practical ideas about inclusion of LGBT people at a time when still over half of the states of our union, there are no state protections. There are no federal protections for LGBTQ people. You could be not hired because you're simply suspected of being LGBT. You could be fired mm-hmm. for being suspected or being found out or thought to be LGBTQ, yeah. and you have no real legal recourse to protect yourself. So,
which is absolutely unacceptable on every level, especially in the United States of America.
Yeah, it is. It's a really bad deal.
Let me ask you this. Let me just change the tempo just a little bit here. You know, one of the things that we focus on at Public Words Project is storytelling and how storytelling and narratives change hearts and minds. I mean, one of the things, you know, when you and I met, we were working on marriage equality in the state of California, and we were both involved with organizations that taught storytelling to change hearts and minds. So give me your thoughts a little bit on narratives and storytelling in modern day politics right now.
I think that storytelling has always been an important part of a politics mm-hmm. for candidates or for advocates or for organizers. You have to, storytelling is really about.
You just cut out. Can you hear me?
It's opening up the opportunity for people to connect, mm-hmm. to empathize, and to at least have a better understanding of where you might be coming from or where another individual may be coming from. Right. So I think that storytelling is just one of the most powerful parts are really about being human.
Exactly.
It's, you know, what we have always been.
Yeah.
Right. It's a relatability. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that by telling your story or the story of another, that someone is going to walk away and say, okay, I see things your way now. I'm going to do what you want me to do because you've told me a great story. We know that that's not always necessarily the case. But I think that what storytelling at least to best effect can do is to get people to maybe think a little differently about a particular subject or an idea. Mm-hmm. It can help to humanize, to empathize, or at least have a little more compassion. You know, what we were doing, as you described, was really just that. You know, you can't necessarily always move people in the political realm on what we like to think. You know, like mm-hmm. this is rational. It is rational that people believe that climate change is happening, and we've got to do this, that, and the other to prevent. The you know, destruction eventually of the human race, you know. Mm-hmm. People aren't necessarily moved by, you know, like, well, we know what the scientific facts are. You know, we clearly have a number of folks in the Congress and a president who just don't want to believe it or don't care to hear it or refute, mm-hmm. right? And build policies, and they have particular interests that, you know, are firmly vested in refuting rational, you know, scientifically proven fact about things.
Right.
So I think that that's a great example in terms of storytelling, why it's important now around what we do see, how it is affecting people's daily lives. I think that when we look at the hurricanes and how, you know, on climate change, so I don't want to go too much on a tangent, but I think that similar to the marriage equality debate, a lot of people just presumed that you know, if we just spoke to the facts, if we just spoke to the more rational ideas around civil rights and inclusion and equality, that people would jump up and say, "Oh yes, well then, you know, God damn it, you're right."
Right? Yeah. You know, you mean, yeah. Hallelujah, amen, let's save the world. Yeah, I get it, yeah.
That's right. And we know that most social change really occurs, if ever, in that particular fashion. Otherwise, I think that Native Americans or Indigenous people, I think that, you know, in the case of other ways in which we have treated each other throughout human history, that would be different. Mm-hmm. We would be living in a utopia. We would be living on a paradise earth if that were the case. But the power of storytelling and sharing your story and is really about relatability and really about empathy and connection and hopefully trying to understand each other better.
Mm-hmm. Well, Andrea Shorter, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to meet with me. To people who have been listening to this podcast, we did this over the internet, and there are some times where it cuts out a little bit, so please bear with us, and please stay continued with us, stay with us. Both Andrea and I have had lots of distractions while we've been trying to do this podcast, so please celebrate that we've completed this. And we were going to be asking Andrea Shorter to come back and talk to us more about her work with her political life in San Francisco and helping to get the new, brand new, fantastic mayor in place. So Andrea Shorter, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It is great to listen to you and have this podcast with you, because you are one of my heroes. And I celebrate you as a friend, as a sister, and as a fantastic leader in our community. So thank you so much. And stay tuned for our next podcast, and check out our Instagram, where we're going to have a picture of Andrea Shorter and some of her great work. And thank you so much, Andrea.
Thank you. Thanks for doing this.